from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. American companies can not only save money by moving labor-intensive work abroad, they can also get top-flight talent overseas. Trade experts say unless the United States can produce better educated workers, it risks losing its position as the world's innovator. Tonight on Point, the education gap and America's future in the global economy. But first, the independent commission investigating the September 11th terrorist attacks holds high-profile hearings tomorrow and Wednesday in Washington. Key members of the Bush and Clinton administrations will testify, including former counterterrorism chief Richard Clark, who in the last 24 hours has made sensational claims of pre-9/11 negligence by the Bush administration. Michael Isikoff is correspondent for Newsweek magazine. I asked him how Richard Clark's claims could affect the hearings.
It definitely charges up the atmosphere considerably. This is about the most politically damaging critique of the Bush administration's handling of the war on terror that has come down the pike to date. And it comes from somebody who is indisputably a highly credible source. Richard Clark was the chief counterterrorism guy in both the Clinton and the early days of the Bush administration. He was there. He's somebody who, for whatever his faults, and he does have faults, cannot be accused of underestimating the threat of al-Qaeda. He was somebody who was sounding the alarm during the Clinton years and was sounding the alarm during the months prior to 9/11 when the Bush administration was in office.
Michael, remind us of the origins of this commission and what it is ultimately supposed to accomplish.
It is supposed to give the country a full accounting of what happened on September 11th and what went wrong within the United States government that allowed it to happen. And on this latter point, Clark's critique is right on the topic. It is inside the White House and discusses how the bin Laden threat and al-Qaeda was perceived during those 9 months while George Bush was in office.
Who else is going to be testifying over these next couple of days?
Well, it's going to be quite a star-studded lineup. We've got Secretary of State Powell, Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld, Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage, I understand, may be testifying in lieu of Condoleezza Rice, the National Security Advisor, who the Bush White House has refused to allow to testify in public, although she has spoken to the commission for over 4 hours in private. In addition, on Wednesday, CIA Director George Tenet will be testifying in public on this. So that is going to be, in and of itself, a pretty crucial questioning.
And will we also see some high-ranking Clinton administration officials in these states?
Yes, I'm sorry. Sandy Berger, who was the National Security Advisor under Clinton, will be testifying. Madeleine Albright actually leads off the testimony tomorrow morning, the former Secretary of State under Bill Clinton. There will also be Bill Cohen, who's Bill Clinton's Secretary of Defense, will precede Secretary Rumsfeld.
So how do these 2 days of testimony fall into the overall arc of this commission's work? Have they built up their entire understanding of what happened so that they can ask the most pointed questions in the next 2 days?
These 2 days of hearings deal with diplomatic and intelligence matters. There are a whole range of other major issues that the commission will be dealing with in coming months, including law enforcement. FBI Director Bob Mueller is scheduled to testify at hearings later on in the spring. And of course, let's not forget that both Bill Clinton and George Bush will be testifying before the commission, although not in public.
Now, ultimately, the commission is supposed to come out with some final conclusion. When is that due, Michael?
That is now due in July. It had been due in May. The commission complained that it didn't have enough time to complete its work, in part because it didn't feel it was getting full cooperation from the Bush White House. You know, the political backstory of the September 11th commission is a fascinating one in its own right. The Bush White House didn't want to have this commission. Mm-hmm. It resisted it to the end in Congress, and then once it was named, was perceived by many commissioners as not cooperating with it. The Bush White House has always claimed consistently that it had nothing to hide and nothing to worry about. I think at a minimum, Dick Clark's allegations and his book clearly belie that claim by the Bush White House.
And then there's the fascinating point that the executive director of the commission, Philip Zelikow, has recused recused himself from some portion of testimony.
Yeah, this is a bit awkward for the commission. Zelikow is a highly regarded academic, but he has also had ties to the government and in particular to key figures in the Bush administration. In fact, Phil Zelikow co-authored a book a number of years ago with Condoleezza Rice, the national security advisor. And to many, that seemed like an overly cozy relationship for a commission that was supposed to be independently investigating the actions of both the Clinton and the Bush administration.
Wasn't he also involved with the transition team from Clinton to Bush?
He was on the transition team, and we now have Clark saying that he was actually involved in one of the early briefings of the Bush transition team by the Clinton White House about the counterterrorism threat. So in that sense, how Phil Zelikow responded and what recommendations he might have made on this subject would be within the orbit and jurisdiction of the commission that he is serving as executive director.
Michael, where and what do you expect the most pointed questions be in these next 2 days?
Well, I think in light of Clark's statements and his book, clearly he is going to be the most sensational witness. One would expect he's going to get some very favorable questioning, and he's scheduled to testify on Wednesday, by the way. Tim Romer, one of the more partisan Democrats on the commission, will be leading the questioning of Richard Clark, so you can expect him to elicit a lot of the damaging things that Clark has had to say in his book to get Clark to repeat those in his public testimony. And I think you're going to see some pretty pointed questionings from Republicans on the commission. Look for Fred Fielding, a experienced lawyer who is one of the Bush appointees on the commission, John Lehman, perhaps some other Republicans on the commission to ask some pretty pointed questions of Clark saying, look, you were there. You had an opportunity to do something about this issue. Why didn't you take more aggressive steps? Even if you claim to have known how serious the Al-Qaeda threat was, did you ask to meet with the president about this?
And when it comes, finally, Michael, to the consequences of all this inquiry, are they essentially political? There are no punitive powers here, no executive powers in this commission. It's just the power to expose what they've learned.
Well, look, I mean, this is one of the seminal events of American history, and there has been no major public accounting to date that tells the full story and tries to place accountability. That's been a buzzword for the families of 9/11 victims and for many in Congress. We obviously had some pretty major flaws and screw-ups that led up to 9/11, yet nobody has been held accountable. Nobody has been fired. Nobody has been disciplined for letting down their guard, for not doing their job. The commission is committed to telling the full story, and I think you're going to hear a lot more about accountability. And, of course, the ultimate accountability issue is now going to be framed in terms of this election in November, should George W. Bush be reelected on his record on terrorism.
Michael Isikoff, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Michael Isikoff is a correspondent for Newsweek. He spoke with me from Washington. The United States remains number one in economic output, but in one recent global assessment of math skills, American eighth graders ranked 19th worldwide. Performers 1 through 5 were Singapore, South Korea, Taiwan, Hong Kong, and Japan. And that doesn't capture the up-and-coming millions in China and India. While the country debates low-wage outsourcing, the real long-range competition is over high-end research and development, over high-value innovation itself. Lose the education race, and that, too, can be outsourced. On some fronts, it's already happening. Tonight on Point, world-beating prosperity and world-beating education. In a globalizing world, you can't ultimately have one without the other. So will the United States stay competitive? Why aren't American students matching up? Are American leaders ducking the real fundamental issue? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Wall Street Journal reporter John Harwood, who last week wrote an article entitled Competitive Edge of U.S. is at Stake in the R&D Arena. Good evening and welcome, John Harwood.
Hey, Tom.
Hi, thanks for being with us. Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Mr. Harwood.
John Harwood, you lay out a tough case here. You say that if these competing companies outpaced the United States in education, that ultimately the 200,000 or so jobs that have been outsourced and have created so much furor politically in the last 6 or 8 months may seem trivial. Why?
Well, you know, it's one thing to lose jobs to call centers in Bangalore where people call up their credit card company or their airline company for a customer service and get somebody across the ocean. But when you start looking at the core advantage of the United States, which is that we have a knowledge advantage over the rest of the world and have for some time, that's really where what is at the root of U.S. living standards and keeping those high. And if you start to see the really high-end intellectual work be outsourced, then you really get into a question of how is it exactly that the United States is going to preserve the living standards that we've gotten used to, which are the best in the world.
John Harwood, you're just back from Singapore. How do you make the case that that knowledge advantage, that innovation edge, is really at risk?
Well, it's simply that there is substantial concern among people that I talk to who are experts in trade who say that you know, this outsourcing is about 10% of the jobs that have been lost during George W. Bush's administration. That's not the real problem. The real problem is over 10, 20 years if, in fact, the high-end work starts to be done elsewhere. And if you have these huge societies in India and China that place very high value on education, see that as their emergence economically, they start turning out very, very talented graduates who can outcompete ours. If that starts to happen, and it hasn't really happened, then we've got some big economic problems.
And John, what are the pieces of the puzzle that these concerned observers, let's say, and Carly Fiorina, a CEO of Hewlett-Packard, said recently, there is no job that is America's God-given right anymore. What are the pieces of the puzzle that have them worried when they look out at American performance, when they look out at what's gathering abroad?
Well, it really starts with the subpar performance of U.S. grade school kids. And that, by the way, that problem could get worse over time because one of the things that the United States is counting on over the next generation is a large influx of Hispanic immigrants, which, of course, is already continuing from Mexico. That's going to help us avoid some of the problem that societies in Japan and Europe, which are aging very rapidly, mm-hmm. are going to have with sustaining a workforce. But those immigrants from Mexico tend to have lower education achievement levels. So when you look across the range of the American workforce, we've really got to do a better job to raise the performance, especially on math and science, those fields that end up fueling the R&D sectors, to compete with these societies where the test scores are quite good and where there's a tremendous emphasis on educational achievement.
And as you point out, even in advance of that very big demographic shift to come, the United States is still just ranking 19th in math skills testing, with all these Asian nations lined up right at the top rungs on the ladder. Jack Beattie, we've talked a lot about outsourcing and all the issues surrounding that globalization on this show. John Harwood's raising something that goes right to the heart of American economic value creation.
He sure is. I was out in Stanford University recently, and I interviewed Paul Romer, a brilliant young economist there who many think is going to win a Nobel Prize one of these days. And his field is economic growth. What causes economic growth? And to boil it down to an idea, to one word, ideas cause economic growth. Not capital, it helps, not necessarily labor, but this factor called ideas, which congeals into technology, which makes everyone more productive, which raises the standard of living. So anything that impedes the production of ideas, of that sort of human capital, throttles economic growth. Therefore, he looks at K-12 education, and he says, instead of talking about trade, This is what the candidate should be talking about. How do we raise the performance of everybody in the public school, in all schools? Mm.
Jack Beatty, John Harwood, please stand by. We're talking tonight about the final and most dangerous frontier, outsourcing innovation, and the fundamental challenge to America's education system. Can the U.S. compete long-term with a mediocre education for its citizens? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the final and most dangerous economic frontier, outsourcing innovation, and the fundamental challenge to America's education system. We're joined tonight by John Harwood. He's a Wall Street Journal reporter just back from Singapore. He's been writing about the challenge from Asia, but it's not only Asia that's educating very highly skilled workers. The issue is whether American workers are being educated to a level where they will hang on to high-value innovation. You can join our conversation tonight. If China and India produce 300,000 engineers a year and the U.S. produces 60,000, where will the jobs go? And if cutting-edge R&D goes abroad, what's left for America? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-8255. Talk, John Harwood, I wish you'd fill out the picture a little bit. I spent a lot of time in Asia and Japan in particular in the 80s. And as you recall, everybody was terrified in those days of the Japanese tsunami was going to roll right across the U.S. economy and, you know, take all the goodies. Instead, we saw Japan flat on its back most of the 90s, the U.S. having a tremendous economic growth and technological innovation. Why won't that simply be repeated?
Well, this is one of the reasons why it's difficult to get the political system to focus on this, because we've been so recently through the scare that you described. I really think what's different about this situation is the potential scale of that competition. When you talk about unlocking the human potential in China, in India, that is, between those two countries, that's one-third of the world's population, and there's a lot of talent there. Now, there's no doubt about it. Their university systems and their knowledge centers are nowhere near ours right now. We still have half a million foreign students come over for advanced education every year, and the leading countries right now sending students are China and India. So they can't match us at the university level. They can't match Silicon Valley or Research Triangle Park. But the question is whether, and as you mentioned a moment ago, there's nothing written in stone that says the United States is going to hold that advantage for decades. And if you start seeing sustained competition from these very, very large societies, and if our society sort of slacks off on this priority, you can definitely see the seeds of an erosion.
John, do you see any reluctance on the part of American corporate leaders to send research and development abroad, to send high-level innovation abroad? It's one thing to outsource call centers and of course, manufacturing. We've seen that. But even from a corporate point of view, does it not raise concerns in their minds about these other countries simply grabbing on to this innovation and ultimately spinning out their own companies and the entire American link being lost?
Well, that is beginning to happen, and one of the things that Charlene Barshefsky, who was the U.S. trade rep under the Clinton administration, one of the things that she is urging that our government do is provide tax incentives to prevent U.S. corporations from moving R&D overseas. It hasn't happened to a large extent, but it is beginning to happen, and these companies increasingly are international in scope and are not reluctant to put their resources where they can find, A, the talent, and, B, the low costs.
John Harwood, I want to thank you very much for your fresh reporting on this, and thank you for being with us tonight.
You bet.
John Harwood, correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. He spoke with us from Washington. I want to welcome into our conversation from Great Falls, Virginia, Catherine Mann. She's a senior fellow at the Institute for International Economics, adjunct professor of management at Vanderbilt University's Owen School of Management. Good evening and welcome, Catherine Mann.
Good evening.
Thanks for being with us. And with us from Alexandria, Virginia, Tom Lovelace, senior fellow and director of the Brown Center on Education Policy at the Brookings Institution, author of The Tracking Wars, State Reform Meets Social Policy. Good evening and welcome. Tom Lovelace.
Thanks for having me.
Catherine, first to you, how real is this threat of the United States, not today, not tomorrow, but in some years, losing what we've assumed would always be the core of the American economy, the very high-tier research and development and innovation that's brought so much wealth to this economy?
I'm not going to disagree with anything that the previous speakers have said, because the arguments are very, very good. And coming, you know, later on in the conversation, it gives me an opportunity to just add a few nuances to what they have already said. And the nuances go in a couple of different directions. One is that looking at mathematical test scores may not be the best measure of what it takes to be successful in the global knowledge wars.
What do you mean by that? Why not?
Well, what I mean is that taking a test, mathematical formulas, even word problems for math, aren't always going to be the best indicator of what is the package of innovative, creative people who are going to have the biggest ideas in the next 20 years.
So are you saying that American culture somehow, we've heard this before,
it's
produces greater innovation, more creative thinkers, whether or not the kids bring home the top scores, and so don't worry, Martha, we're fine?
I wouldn't say don't worry, we're fine. I'm not saying we shouldn't worry about it. I think we should worry a lot. But I also am concerned that the focus on a single test, that will leave aside some of the package of skills that people have to have as we move into an environment with a lot of richness in ideas and a lot of richness in what is with what we do with those ideas. When I was asked what should college students be thinking about when they're finishing up now, in their graduating in May and so forth, I'm telling them you have to be coming out with technical skills, but you also have to be coming out with people skills. You have to be coming out with skills that allow you to have a flexible response to a changing situation, whether it's with a customer or with a problem. And you also have to be willing and understand that you are going back to school, and you're going to go back to school more than once in your life. And I think that is different, that package, and how we teach to that package, starting very young, is different from taking the test. It is different from some of the standards of learning tests or the No Child Left Behind accountability. What comes out at the end of that pipeline that focuses entirely on tests, I'm not sure that thing that comes out of the pipeline is the type of student that actually will win the global innovation race.
Tom Loveless, step in here. We've got on the one hand John Harwood saying he's out reporting. He sees these great advances in big numbers of highly educated workers abroad, test scores at home not looking so good, and corporate people, U.S. trade officials worried about that. Catherine Mann saying that may not be the whole picture. Is there some kind of cultural protection here, some kind of intangible that's concrete beyond the test score that will protect U.S. high-tier jobs long-term?
I'm not an economist, but I can comment on culture only in the aspect of it could be culture that's actually limiting our mathematical achievement in some respects. We don't the countries that John Harwood ticked off as the leaders of mathematics, and he indeed is right, top five are all Asian nations, but they're European nations as well that outscore us. So one thing they have in common is a tremendous emphasis in the K through 12 years on mastering mathematics. They simply take it as children's jobs, really, to go to school and do the best we can. In the United States, we don't culturally. We just don't see school that way. Schools in the United States are for kids to sample a broad range of subjects to find out what their interests are. So there could be a cultural influence here that's prohibiting and holding down American achievement, at least in mathematics.
Is that a problem, or we've done fine with it so far, so we can just roll along? Thank you very much.
I think it is a problem. Let me defend math tests for just a minute. I think Catherine's right. There's no evidence that math achievement tests uncover innovation or the ability to engage in innovative practices. But what they are very good at, we've found out through longitudinal studies, is they're highly predictive. The mathematical knowledge that kids demonstrate on tests when they're in high school are predictive of a lot of quality of life indicators later in life, including wages. So at least in terms of individual productivity, going to school, studying mathematics, and really learning mathematics is correlated with later achievement economically.
Well, I'm looking here at a fresh report from Gartner, the IT consultancy, which is projecting that by the year 2010, which, by the way, is just 6 years from now, up to 25% of traditional IT jobs will be relocated to developing countries. That's a lot of jobs. Jack Meadie, you look out on this picture of countries educating lots and lots of global citizens to compete. Do you see the United States with some kind of blessed long-term status here that's going to protect it from that or not?
Not in a world where trade is characterized by acquired advantages, not comparative advantages, acquired ones. And one of them is knowledge, universities, training, the brains of their citizens. So there's nothing guaranteeing our preeminence in this at all. And there are forces working against it. I mean, some people think that trade and technology together are acting as a giant scissors on the American job base. They point to studies in the 1960s when the word automation first came into use, hearings on it in Congress, and a future was sketched out in which machines would do more and more and people less and less, and mass unemployment would become a fact of life in America and around the world. Well, those fears have been revived because of the nature of the information revolution we've had in the 90s. Bill Joy, the computer scientist, has even got even darker scenarios about the robots taking over. We don't have to go that far, though, but just look at what the Census report, the Census Bureau says. They predict that the big job gains in the future will be in what? Restaurants, retail sales, nursing, face-to-face activities, low-skill activities. And in this, we've sort of built a middle-class lifestyle up on a platform based around mass production and really assembly line-like organization in all forms of work, even in a lot of office work and managerial work.
Knowledge work. Mm-hmm.
Knowledge work. Well, now technology is going like that scissors is going right at that. And these two forces together may be just creating a moment here where we're not going to have the jobs, and that in some sense one of our dilemmas may be what to do with and about all these educated people for whom there aren't going to be the mass job available.
I guess the traditional view was have them so well educated that they compete globally to the point that they attract those jobs. Let's hear what our callers have to say on all this. Jeff is calling from Belmont, Massachusetts. Hi, Jeff. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I wanted to sort of put the point that Jack just made in context. But first, let me just say that where I'm coming from, I work for a technical computing software company in Massachusetts. We have about 1,000 people. And I would say if I walk down the halls and look at the nameplates on the offices, maybe, you know, 3 or 4 out of 10 people are from Asia.
So a high percentage. Are you talking Americans, or are you talking workers who have come over just to share their skills?
I think most of them are here on work visas.
Mm-hmm.
I really don't know. You know, many of them have settled here. They have families here, and, you know, and they're part of the American scene. But still, there they are, and they're great contributors, and I work well with them. But, you know, I keep wondering, you know, why are there so many of them here when there are so many people from America, you know, who would like these jobs? And I think, you know, it isn't like the company is outsourcing jobs. They have a few people working overseas. They have foreign offices, but most of the R&D is happening in America. So
what's your conclusion? What's your conclusion, Jeff?
My conclusion is that the American system, the educational system, the commercial system, the governmental system, is educating consumers, and it's not really educating producers.
Ooh, fascinating. Let us take that to Catherine Mann. And Jeff, thanks for your call. Catherine, how about it?
I think that he's got an interesting thesis there that where we don't really produce people who are going to produce products. where I define products both as goods and services.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I want to get back to the point about whether or not, you know, who is it that we need, you know, what is it that we are going to be producing 10 years from now, and who is it that we need to have doing it?
Please tell us. We're dying to know.
Well, first, I'm not sure nursing has low skills. Maybe retail trade does, but nursing certainly doesn't.
Though
but
it also, has not, though, historically, it's not historically been a center of great value creation.
Nursing?
Yeah.
Not, no, well, I don't know.
I mean, wealth creation, let's say, the kind that countries become, you know, rich on. It hasn't traditionally come from nursing.
No, but I think there are a lot of things that that we wouldn't generate value off of, but we would consider to be very valuable.
But we're talking here about the economic status and standard of living of the United States.
And in the end, I come back to where I said that the people who we are graduating have to have a package of skills that go beyond just the technology workers who are in the cubicles. That's not good enough. Those people can be outsourced because they sit by themselves in a cubicle. The much higher value added contribution to wealth creation in the U.S. economy is going to come from the people who have the package of skills. Technology, absolutely yes, and no, we're not doing enough of it. But they also have to have people skills so they can see what is the need in the marketplace for design, for customization, to move away from that mass production-based platform that the previous speaker mentioned.
Boy, I have to say, though, I hear a kind of complacency in that, Catherine Mann.
Individuals who are unique.
I have to say I hear a kind of complacency in that. I mean, we're reading here about pods of very high-tier workers abroad already kicking in, already beginning to do very sophisticated R&D work about much different ratios of managers to staff abroad, not just faceless, you know, masses of workers, but a different ratio, more managers to workers abroad that let them be more responsive and more creative. I mean, what's to say that that package of skills, it sounds kind of vague. What's to say that you won't have lots of people with that same package of skills in India or China, better educated, lower wage, and boom, you've got the competition problem at the highest end of research?
I think that some of these other countries are not yet in a position of producing the same package of skills. More importantly, I think in many cases the package of skills that people have within a country is unique to that country, that it is not necessarily transferable across national borders, that maybe because of regulatory climates in a country, for example, healthcare regulations, legal regulations, financial regulations, that create an environment in a country where what is being designed, what products are being created, what wealth is being created, what new ideas are being created are unique to the place in which they are being developed.
Jack, this kind of comes back to the perspective that the United States has some kind of birthright on the far horizon, that we've got the innovation gene, the innovation package of skills here.
Well, that's what we thought about ourselves. George Santayana said the only indigenous American religion is belief in tomorrow. And that's certainly been our hallmark. But I guess I'm just much less sanguine that this sort of thing can't be, that other nations can't get it. And, you know, people have pointed out that many of these societies had mass war as an experience. China, certainly, years of it, Japan, Germany, and that in a strange way, that has advantaged them. It cleared away so much deadwood and barnacle, you know, and old practices that in a strange way they started anew. And we're still in our continuity, and that continuity goes back to Henry Ford and all that stuff.
Goes way back. Jack, we'll come back and look just at that. We're talking about outsourcing innovation tonight. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the final and most dangerous economic frontier, outsourcing innovation, and the fundamental challenge to America's education system. You can join the conversation tonight. If innovation is one day not a comparative advantage for the United States, what can replace that? And do you hear an urgent conversation around education in the presidential campaign this year or not? Why not? Is there something about America that makes Americans great innovators even when they're not the best educated? Are you willing to bet the future on that? We're at 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight by Catherine Mann, Senior Fellow at the Institute for International Economics, and by Tom Lovelace, Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institution. A couple of quotes for you here. One from Charlene Barshefsky, U.S. Trade Representative under President Clinton. "We absolutely must strengthen our talent pool," she says. "Otherwise, we will lose our competitive edge within a generation." And from Carla Hills, U.S. Trade Representative under the first President Bush, "We are producing fewer math and science majors than China or India per year. Does this make sense when we want to move up the knowledge ladder?" "I think not," says Carla Hills. You can join us. James is calling from Duxbury, Massachusetts. James, welcome. You're on the air.
Yes, thanks. Thanks, Tom. Yeah. I wanted to say that I think that you're talking to the wrong people. You're talking to educators and commentators on economics. The people you should be talking or thinking about are the people who are actually doing the innovation. And what if you go to any scientific meeting in the United States, you find the people who are talking, who are doing the innovation, are people based in the United States who are immigrants from abroad. And the United States has always attracted immigrants. The United States, I don't think, could have put a man on the moon without the talents of the German rocket scientists.
James, what do you take away from that then? Can the U.S. continue to rely on that?
Yes, I think that what has happened is that people come to the United States with talent to be liberated by the systems that are in place in the United States. As you rightly put it, the ability to look at tomorrow. In America, that's valued. Innovation is valued. They leave stultifying systems where talent is not recognized, and I think they'll continue to do that. And it doesn't matter. Americans have always been rather poorly educated in comparison to many other countries, and the United States shouldn't worry about that.
Well,
they will be able to hire the talent.
James, we hear you loud and clear, and thank you for your call. Tom Lovelace, you know that in many dimensions, James is right. The U.S. has always attracted talent from overseas. So can we continue to count on that to bring home the bacon in an era when overseas economies are so much more developed than they've been over the last century?
Well, I don't think we should be complacent and simply say, well, you know, we've never really educated people very well, and that's the way it is. That's the way it'll continue to be. There are other consequences of that. We do know, for instance, that certain segments of our society who are not educated very well tend to be racial minorities or different ethnic groups, Hispanics, African Americans. Also, children from poor families, they're not educated very well. So there are consequences for that, social consequences that we need to be concerned about. I want to get back to the countries that are achieving very well in mathematics. The one thing they do is they have student accountability systems. I know up in Massachusetts, the MCAS has been rather controversial. But in all of those Asian nations, they have tests that kids have to pass, and those tests have very high stakes attached to them. That's something we don't have in the United States, and we're just beginning. Through No Child Left Behind and some of the other programs that states have adopted, we're just beginning to put those kinds of systems into play.
So are you saying the Bush emphasis on standardized testing right across the country is the answer, that that's going to raise the scores and create the kind of graduates that will create that very high-end economic value?
What it does is it makes education more transparent. It states what it is kids need to learn, and then it tests them to find out whether or not they have learned it. And it also provides incentives for kids to be learning it and for teachers to be teaching it. Without that kind of transparency and those kinds of incentives built in, which the rest of the world has, we really are an international outlier on that. Without those incentives and that transparency, then you're not going to have an emphasis on learning. Another big reason for us falling behind is that our teachers aren't prepared as well as they are in other countries. Singapore, for instance, the country that scores at the top of both fourth and eighth grade testing in math, 78% of their teachers at the eighth grade were math majors. In the United States, it's less than half,
which is
41%.
That's a very big difference. Catherine Mann, let me put a couple of these things to you. First, our caller James says, the United States has never had the best education, but it's always been a huge magnet for foreign minds. First of all, do you think that will continue? Can the U.S. rely on that when economies overseas may be creating much more attractive opportunities than they have in the past, and when globalization may be spreading the kind of innovation culture that has historically been more American-oriented?
I think we can't be complacent. And not about the nature of our business environment as being more conducive to innovation, not in terms of our students and whether or not they can get away with being poorly educated. What I worry about, though, is with the focus and taking all as legitimate the comments about transparency of the educational system and so forth, a couple of things. First, learning subject matter is not the same as learning how to think. People who learn how to think are innovators. People who learn the subject matter can be outsourced.
So you're saying this is the kind of Japan critique. They score very well on the test, but they don't have the same kind of rowdy innovation spirit acculturated in them that Americans do?
Well, as I say, it is different to learn subjects than to learn how to think. They're not mutually exclusive, but they are also not the same. The second point is that some of the comments you've made earlier sort of suggest there's a certain amount of innovative activity in the world, and if we don't do it here, they're going to get it over there. I think that that's not a good way of thinking about the nature of innovation and having a little competition around the world in terms of innovative activity and bright minds working in different places around the world. That creates a little competition for innovation, and I'm not sure that's not a bad thing.
But you know that innovation has historically been kind of pod-oriented. We've had Silicon Valley as a big American pod around Boston in North Carolina's Research Triangle. Those pods don't have to be just in the United States.
And I don't think they should be just in the United States. It's the interaction of Silicon Valley and Route 128 and Triangle Park and Austin. That interaction and that competition among those has been very fruitful, and having that competition expand across international borders is good as well.
So the more the merrier. Listeners, what do you think? Laura is calling from Gay Mills, Wisconsin. Hi, Laura. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm calling from the position of being an educator. I've been an educator for about 30 years. Okay. I've worked in both public and private schools. I was educated in both public and private schools.
Mm-hmm.
And it's good my call's coming in, you know, right after that last comment, because my observation of the biggest difference between public and private schools in this country up till now has been that students in private schools are educated to think, and in public schools they have been explicitly not, because for about a century during all the industrial time, it was not necessary to have workers who thought or who were innovative. They needed to be obedient and do the work and work in the factory.
So what does that
now
leave us today, Laura?
That's changing. And I think that's one of the big issues. And we can't expect the educational system in America to change overnight in such a big way. I also agree that students have mostly been also, Americans have been educated to be good and happy consumers. And my experience with students is that they're much more interested in being consumers of technology than in learning how to create it.
So when you look at this growing international competition as a 30-year educator, do you look at it with confidence that by whatever means the U.S. finally produces a workforce that's going to be fine, or are you concerned?
Well, I'm concerned because I think that the American workforce has been led in one direction for over a century, and now all of a sudden it's going to have to go somewhere else. But the whole cultural milieu, so to speak, about around education is going to have to change, and I don't think that will change overnight. I think Americans have been led to believe that they don't have to be innovative, that they can be happy consumers and there'll be a job for them somewhere. And I don't think that's true anymore. And I don't think you can expect students or educators to be able to turn that around at the snap of a finger.
Do you think standardized testing is the way to address the problem, or is that the thinking killer?
I think we need to start teaching all children how to think. I think that is, I do agree that that is what creates, you know, innovation, you know, is that we teach each other how to think.
Laura, we've got it, and thank you very much for your call. I want to get a few more calls in here if we can. We've got so many waiting. Jamie is calling from Lexington, Massachusetts. Hi, Jamie, you're on the air.
Yes, I was just calling, you know, talking about the issue of student accountability. I think that it is key, and I think that I am concerned that I don't see enough accountability in our schools. My son is in classes with Asian kids that do extremely well in math. We take private classes. They're largely Asian kids. Those kids and their families value education. They're not afraid to take tests. They're not afraid to be high achievers. And I think by and large, we just don't encourage enough accountability. What Catherine was saying about, you know, we have to teach creativity, that's true. But we also have to teach basic skills. And you can't teach basic math skills when someone's 21 years old. They have to have the basics. Once we have the basics nailed, then we can move on to teaching more creative ways to take that knowledge and apply it.
Good. Jamie, those Asian American students you're referring to are Americans too. So should they put our hearts, our minds at ease because they're working so hard there? And why aren't the other students in those classes following that example?
You know, but I guess my question is, you know, I just think it's a cultural thing for those Asian families, even though a lot of some of their parents weren't born here. These kids are being raised here, but their families still value education and high achievement. And I don't think enough European families that have been here for generations put as much value on that. You just see this time and time again.
Yep.
And I think it's a concern, and I do think standardized testing is an important first step. It's not the panacea, but we do need to have it. We need to have accountability. We need to know what people know and what they don't know.
At least lay down those basics. Let's get one more call. David is calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Good evening.
Hi.
Actually, I think the last two callers both had it right. But we've had a complete divestment from public education, and hopefully those immigrant parents and students will bring back a desire to see leadership at the political level, something similar to Kennedy. Yeah, James was right. It was essentially the Germans that brought us rocket technology. But it was Kennedy's vision when he said, listen, let's put a man on the moon. What do we need to do this? Math and science. There was an investment in that, mm-hmm. the high schools at the college level. Ms. Mann talks about, you know, packaging people skills. You know, what are we teaching the kids to confidently say, would you like fries with that? That's not education. We need to teach critical thinking, and we also need to look at mandatory test scores. But the thing is, we need to have a set agenda. Where does this country want to go in the future? What do we want to be? And I think most everybody said it right. We're a consumer culture. It's a group mind think.
And that's going to be challenged. David, thanks for your call. Tom Lovelace, where do you see the education on the political agendas right now? Is it high enough? Is it getting the right attention? Is it keyed up to the level of President Kennedy when he said, let's go to the moon, the same scale for dealing with growing global competition?
It's relatively high. The election years, presidential elections, typically have not involved education at all. But, of course, the one in 2000 did. And the one in 2004 could very well put education again on the front page.
Mm-hmm. And Catherine Mann, we've just got a minute left here, but where are you pinning your hopes now?
Where am I pinning my hopes? Well, you know, for all my comments here that sound, you've sort of suggested that I'm sounding very complacent, I'm not at all. I'm very worried. I think that there is a lot of problems in the educational system, and it fundamentally has to do with the fact that we don't pay teachers very much. It's not a job that people want to do. And you know what? You get what you pay for.
Mm. Catherine Mann at the Institute for International Economics, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
And Tom Lovelace at the Brookings Institution, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
So, Jack, there's a big wide world working overtime to get a piece of the pie. And, of course, the pie can grow in many ways. But they're going to be coming on like gangbusters one way or another.
They sure are, and Laura, with her 30 years experience and our first caller, remind us that more and more consumerism is what we are about, and that tracks very closely with one of the most profound speculations about the changing national character, that of David Reisman in The Lonely Crowd, who says we're changing from inner-directed people to outer-directed, taking our cues from the outside and not really driven by any internal necessity to achieve. That's a scary thought.
Well, I will turn to Carla Hills, U.S. Trade Representative. She says we have to turn inward and take responsibility at the grassroots level and try to deal with the education gap that affects our country. Jack, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation at onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.